Okay, this is continuing with Lawrence Helfer at the AAS on 12 June 1984.
Now, I was a very ignorant theoretician at that time in many things. I don't know how many ideas were in common knowledge, especially since I spent 54 to 56-ish basically in the Army.
Right.
All right, and I was really out of things. I tried to come in on weekends to do some observing, but it was pretty rough. The Burbidge paper was really an excellent paper. I don't know how much of the ideas were original. The idea of using the cosmic ray particles for the source, I'm not quite sure whether it was original or not, because I had been brought up on the Fermi mechanism, and Chandran Fermi had done work on this stuff. So I was aware of it, but I don't know if it was an automatic...
But in any case, that paper certainly made an impact.
But you know, there weren't many people it made an impact on. Astronomers, generally optical astronomers, did not pay any attention to radio astronomy till I'd say somewhere in the 60s. All right? Now, the really devastating thing was the lack of resolution.
Mm-hmm.
That really was serious. There's a book by Palsy on radio astronomy.
Right. Palsy and Bracewell.
That at the end of chapter 1 or 2 has a diagram, or maybe it was in Krauss's book, I don't remember, which had a diagram of wavelength versus sensitivity and resolution.
Mm-hmm.
And you were supposed to pick your telescope.
Right.
The curves go in different directions for a given wavelength. But
you go to the highest frequency you can before you lose sensitivity.
Yeah.
Right.
Or you get confusion limited. Mm-hmm. So you were confusion limited to sensitivity limit. And if you use that diagram, radio astronomy would never have gotten off the ground. All right? Now, it wasn't that we weren't using interferometers,
right,
but there was no efficient way of using interferometers, and certainly not with a big dish. When I came back after the Army, I found out that DTM was making the multi-channels. They made the first multi-channel filter, which worked rather efficiently, and they were also thinking of building a big dish. Howard was designing to see the biggest possible dish you could build.
Right.
And he said, and he came to the conclusion that about a 60-foot dish was the biggest. With a 60-foot dish, radio astronomy was dead, basically.
Right,
that's
still
a long wavelength.
We didn't have
any of the receivers that could work in the 10-centimeter or a shorter wavelength system, and the systems were just too noisy.
Of course, now at the Naval Research Lab across town from where you were, there was an awful lot of microwave work.
Yeah, but
going on.
We knew what they were doing. I was very good friends with, you know, people like Fred Haddock,
mm-hmm,
who was there at the time.
Right.
But still, the receivers were quite noisy, considering the new to the minus 0.7.
Right, you couldn't detect many sources with them.
That's right.
And you certainly couldn't detect the black background.
That's right. So, I mean, it was a field that didn't have much immediate hope for it. Also, an awful lot of technical achievements came in after that. When I came back in from the Army, and we wanted to do 21 centimeters, to get that damn receiver working was another pain in the neck. They rotated between 50 or 54 different channels. They had RC filters,
mm-hmm,
all right? They had to get special condensers that had residual charges of less than a millivolt. They weren't around at the time.
Yeah.
The whole damn thing was put together, and they found, for example, that the sliding contact potential of the rotary switch that they used made too much of a signal. So that had to be thrown out, and a rebuilt one that made before breaking,
so
as you rotate it around. Had
so the
to
whole
be
problem was in the DC offsets.
Yeah, the
background
was terrible. It was very hard to get the receiver working regularly with a constant background. The terrible problem in 21 centimeter was variable background.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't repeat things, you couldn't overlie them or anything. Finally, just before we were getting ready Bill Erickson was there at the time when I came back, and he was working on very low frequencies, and he stuck to it. But then he went to Convair. I was going to it, and I was decided I had basically had it now because I was waiting for the state of the art to improve.
Right.
So I had a postdoc at Caltech.
Starting when now?
Somewhere about 57, all right?
So you left DTN at that point?
I left DTN at that point. But the week before, the month before, the equipment was working, like magic. And what Bill and I did was to quite literally, we did this survey. We didn't turn the receiver off. We didn't go away. We took turns 12 hours a day to get the whole damn survey.
Take advantage of the fact it was working?
Because we knew the damn thing was going to break down. Mm-hmm. And you wanted to see it was a race against time to get all the way around it. So we finished that up, and the actual reductions and tracings we did in California.
And that's what was published in AJ in 1960, yeah. 54 channel receiver, right. Reverse burn, yeah. 12 kilohertz filters.
Right. That's the first detailed survey, probably, that was published. The Dutch didn't believe it at the time.
Why not?
Well, because Ort had this feeling that there were no features you were going to see that had a width of less than 5 kilometers a second. And the first few, you could see, it was something like 4.74 kilocycles per kilometer per second or so. And we had a resolution of, we could clearly see features of 4 kilometers.
Mm-hmm.
And we found out such things as the fact that when you looked in the anti-center, the center region, there were not only tails, but the center, the profile was displaced.
Mm-hmm.
From the theoretical Ort model.
Right.
So we clearly detected the non-circular aspects of the rotation pattern.
So you're saying he distrusted your results on a theoretical basis?
He didn't distrust them. Ort is one of the most brilliant men that we've ever had in astronomy, but he's a stubborn person. And he wanted it confirmed by himself, or his group. He took it. He took it under advisement, but he didn't move an inch on any of those things. All right? I don't think he disbelieved the observations. I just think he said, well, my boys are going to now build the narrower filters, and we'll go ahead on them. Mm-hmm. But we kept telling him the temperatures had to be lower than he was talking about. The lines were narrower. And there were non-circular motions.
I know, the temperature is lower. You haven't talked about this yet. The implied temperatures from the width, right.
Yeah.
But of course, it's a lot of turbulence influencing the width also.
Well, he was talking about 8 kilometers a second for a typical cloud. When you looked at things like the Pleiades, as we did, and one of the papers is so. You found some very narrow elements of clouds. One of them, if I remember, is only a few kilometers a second wide.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really was there on one channel and not on the other.
Right.
Now, I mean, that was clear observational proof that...
it's very cold gas. Right?
That it was very, very cold gas. Mm-hmm. And that the wisps were very much smaller than he had been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
One had to simply wait for that to go on.
If I remember correctly, wasn't there a thesis of one of the group at Harvard that did the Pleiades also for a thesis about this time? Was that at all part of this project? Or?
No, what? I don't remember that.
It may have been another star cluster. Okay, that's all right.
Yeah.
I just thought you...
No, I don't remember that.
Apparently didn't influence your...
I knew Frank Derrick and Heeshan. And they were grad students at the time. But they were not doing this sort of work.
It may have been after that.
Yeah.
Tell me about the out-of-the-plane work that you did, which, of course, was where the Dutch had not been. I mean, you said you found more gas than you expected.
Yeah, in the home arm. And we made, you see, there were two things we wanted to do. We wanted to find out, for example, how big individual little clouds were. Was it well distributed? Was it in a sheet?
Mm-hmm.
Was it in wisps? Was it as much variation as you could think of? Well, obviously one thing to do is to get out of the plane. So there were two ways of doing this. One was to take, say, a meridian survey and just look at the details at, say, B's greater than 5 degrees or 10 degrees. And the other is to take a region well above the plane and make an LB plot of the region in detail. We did both. The Pleiades surveys was the second type. And the two meridian surveys, which I guess are reported in that IUE symposium, were the first type.
The Paris symposium.
The Paris
symposium. IUE. So what you were trying to do, it seems like, was complement the Dutch rotational mapping.
Well, they had done it.
Right. And you had a somewhat bigger antenna, but...
Yeah, there was no reason to redo it.
Yeah.
Unless we could get a real edge on that there. And so, I mean, and there were a hell of a lot of other problems to work on. My God, there were. So, and we were just starting out. So... It struck us that we might as well go off in this direction. Mm-hmm. Actually, all of that choice was mine, because Merle and Howard simply gave me...
You were the astronomer.
I was the astronomer in residence.
Right.
So forth.
That's a rather unusual... Well, once again, in 21 centimeter, not so unusual to have an astronomer around, but in non-21 centimeter, there were not many classically trained astronomers working with these radio groups.
Oh, of course, that's...
Quite like an NRL, for instance.
Well, they had one. Nancy was there.
Yes, that's true. Nancy. She was there for a couple of years, yeah.
More than a couple of years. She was there for quite a while. She was there when I went in 1953, and she remained there until she switched over to NASA. And NASA wasn't formed until 1958.
I guess you're right. It was more than a couple of years.
And she was a good... she was a good, well-trained classical astronomer who did excellent work on Wiclone Cave giants.
Did you visit any foreign radio observatories?
No. At that time, they basically weren't. The foreign observatory consisted of a man who was stringing wire through some cow field. And Merle, too, managed to bring the men over through Washington. If you really think about it, that's basically it. The instruments were just being designed.
Right.
They were the papers, if you look at them, are all really post-53 on the instruments. So you know this guy was building this in this field, but what were you going to do when you went over there? You were going to watch him slave over trying to get a tuner working?
So you're saying there wasn't anything to be learned?
There wasn't really very much to be learned except for construction techniques. Mm-hmm. You know. And my God, I went out with Bernie and the other boys out into the fields at, what was it, Deerfield, something like that.
Oh, what was the name of that place?
The field that they had out in Maryland, where they later put the bigger dish.
I know what you mean, yeah.
But it was just, and I used to go around, and one of my jobs was to get the cows from stopping to nibbling on the wires, you know? I mean, it was that sort of a crazy deal at the time.
Right. What would you say has been the main impact that radio astronomy had on, in this era now, up through the late 50s, on traditional astronomy?
The main impact is that it brought a lot of physicists in. The physicists, the astronomers up until that time, were quite stodgy in regarding astronomy as the problems of astronomers.
Mm-hmm.
And here was the first time that a field opened up that was clearly astronomy, no matter what they did, and yet the astronomers were not per se competent to do all this stuff.
Right.
So electrical engineers by the score and physicists marched in.
Right.
And physicists, you know, have a very special way of looking at problems.
Right.
And that improved, I think, the quality of astronomy very, very much. It made such things as the design of the X-rays and the gamma ray detectors.
Well, this was really the first.
Yes.
We can now see that this was the first of many such different wavelength ranges once again, each with its own influx
right.
of
and
things.
Right, and it was, that's right, it prepared the ground, and NRL had the noble tradition of really helping field after field in the development of these instruments. It also meant people like cosmic ray physicists were now starting to be regarded as doing some astronomy. And there was a natural blending of people together that way.
It broadened the whole definition of astronomy.
Well, I don't know. It did at the point of view of the 80s, but not in the point of view of the 60s. In the point of view of the 60s, astronomy was still astronomers' province, very rarely. Except looking back at it, you can see that people that were gaining the respect of the astronomy community were not astronomers, but astrophysicists. There were people like Lyman Spitzer and Leo Goldberg, all right? I mean, those people knew how to handle ionization equations, and they worked on cooling rates and things like that. And Jeff Burbidge. Jeff's, I think, was the first particle physicist to move into astronomy.
That could well be, yeah.
You know, his training was on Mason physics and so forth. So it's this sort of thing. And Chalosky, of course.
Right. And Ginsberg.
And Ginsberg. These were the guys that started to move into the field, and their specialties were in physics.
Yeah.
And they toned the field up.
That's a very good point. Well, any other comments that...
No. Nothing was very organized in those days. It was a lot more haphazard and less professional than we are accustomed to today. DTM, quite literally the director, spent hours after hour banging equipment to make it work. And I don't mean in a literal sense, but I mean quite literally kicking chassis
right.
to trying to get them to sort of fall right. into a better position.
Right.
I mean, is that, it was as crazy as that.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That ends the new interview with Helfer on 12 June 1984.